I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we'll be revisiting the subject of Iran, its relationship to the United States, and geopolitics. This time with historian Arash Azizi, author of The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions. Trust me when I say that this particular episode is extremely relevant in light of the upcoming presidential election in Iran on June 18th. We'll be discussing that, as well as some of the themes and points made in Azizi's book, the aforementioned The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And before we dive into the conversation, my apologies for the lack of shows released earlier in the week. Usually we have a show out by Monday or Tuesday at the latest, but my erratic schedule as of late prevented that. But not to fear, because we have a number of fascinating and exciting guests coming up on future editions of the program. So Parallax Views is far from done. With all that in mind, let's get right to the conversation with Arash Azizi, author of The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest I've been wanting to get on with a very interesting book entitled The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions. Arash Azizi, welcome to Parallax Views.
Hello, thank you very much for having me. It's an honor. Thank you.
So before we started recording, you were telling me that you were watching the Iranian presidential debates. For my listeners here in the U.S., what would you tell them about the upcoming Iranian elections? If I have a few listeners that may not be following it as closely as they should be. I've had listeners recently tell me that they enjoy me covering these discussions of foreign politics and foreign policy, because a lot of people are maybe a little bit more unaware than they should be when it comes to these issues.
Yeah, for sure. Although this Iranian presidential elections are not much of an election, frankly. These are this is a turning point in the history of the Islamic Republic. The Iranian elections have never been free, of course, under the Islamic Republic, and they have never been free. But they're usually competitive. So different wings of the ruling regime are able to compete with each other, and so they're meaningful competitive elections, even within a very narrow field. This time, however, the vetting body called the Guardian Council that gets to decide who gets to run has basically thrown out all candidates who could have been a threat to a guy who is the front runner. And basically, you know, we can already presume him the winner, 90%, I'd say. And that's Ebrahim Raisi, a cleric who has a past in the Iranian judiciary, has always been a side figure. So the real story here is that the Iranian supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei, who already controls 80-90% of power in Iran, wants to make sure that a loyalist, and sort of a useless loyalist who has no chance of ever becoming a serious contender of power to himself, is going to also control the presidency, which was previously held by a sort of a centrist conservative, Hassan Rouhani, who was supported by many reformists and who had some aspirations to change the direction of Iran foreign policy, or perhaps to challenge either Ayatollah Khamenei or the militia called Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC, which is the main source of Khamenei's power. So to long story short, I don't know when this will broadcast, but Iran elections are June 18th, and they seem to become basically a coronation for Ebrahim Raisi, who will become Iran's next president.
And there were a number of candidates that were completely rejected, right? I think even the former president, Ahmadinejad ran, he was rejected as a candidate. Could you tell my listeners a little bit more about that, how these candidates were rejected, and just maybe just some more details on that kind of thing?
Yeah, so wide majority of, vast majority of candidates were rejected. Only seven were allowed to run, five conservatives, one centrist, and one very marginal reformist who, the two non-conservatives have really very little chances of winning. But yes, among those who were rejected is former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Now, Ahmadinejad, you can classify him as a conservative, of course, but the fact of the matter is Ahmadinejad has actually emerged as a major, can say almost anti-regime critique in the 8 years that he's been out of power. He is very daring. He criticizes Khamenei directly. He doesn't mince his words. He's basically called for a boycott of the elections, which is the first in the history of Islamic Republic of Iran that a former president calls for a boycott of elections, I believe. And he is a good populist. He knows how to sort of talk about people's economic problems, given that Iran is going through some of its worst economic shape. All candidates in these debates also basically know that and have to talk about it. But so, yes, Ahmadinejad was rejected. And it's no surprise that Khamenei would never let someone like Ahmadinejad back near power, now that he has emerged, as I said, as a trenchant critique of Iran's ruling establishment. But it's interesting that the other candidates thrown out, someone like Ali Larijani, who used to be, he's a conservative sort of a little centrist because he supported President Rouhani. He is a very much a man of power, comes from the religious city of Qom and a big clerical family, even though he isn't a cleric himself. And he used to be a speaker of parliament. He is, as establishment a guy as you can possibly imagine. But because he could have become sort of a rival of centrist or pro-Rouhani people and seriously threatened Raisi's re-election, his candidacy was thrown out. And he was actually so disrespected that Khamenei had to sort of apologize to him in sort of a public speech, which was followed by the Guardian Council declaring that, their decision has not changed despite Khamenei's sort of apology to Larijani, and that Larijani would have still and not be able to run. Of course, many other people who tried to run were also rejected. And as with every presidential election since 1979, the application of every single woman who tried to run was also rejected. The Guardian Council making clear that the presidency is reserved not only for pro-Khamenei people, but also only for men.
And I was just going to add, for the sake of my listeners, ultimately, Rouhani is ineligible for re-election. He's served his terms. With regards to Ebrahim Raisi, what should we know about him, since it does look like he is going to be the next Iranian president?
The most important thing about Raisi is that he is basically useless. And I'll tell you what I mean by this. He is not only a loyalist, as I said, a loyalist, conservative loyalist to Khamenei, but also he's someone who doesn't have any political experience. He spent most of his life in judiciary. The other important power position that he's had is he's been the head of a religious shrine in the city of Mashhad for Imam Reza. That's the only Shia imam who is buried in Iran. It's an important religious center, but also happens to be when you're head of that, you're head of a multi-billion dollar economic empire based in northeastern Iran and Mashhad, the city of Mashhad, Iran's second biggest city after the capital Tehran. His father-in-law, Ahmad Alam al-Hoda, is the Friday prayer leader, sort of a religious magnet, if you will, in Khorasan, which is in the northeastern province of Khorasan, where Mashhad is. So these are his sort of links to the establishment. But he was also a candidate 4 years ago. He lost. He was bad in debates 4 years ago. He's bad in debates now. He's not a charismatic politician. He doesn't really have what it takes to become a serious rival to Khamenei and to the clerical establishment of, you know, something like 200-300 people who really are the hardcore of power in Iran. And that's the story of, you know, that's why he's being coronated effectively, because they want to have a power that is more united. I should also say that Ayatollah Khamenei, Supreme Leader of Iran, is 82 years old. He's known to not be super healthy. He's very likely that he'll die in the not far off future. And in those conditions, the question of who will replace him, the succession crisis, will become very important. And now there's a chance that this will be Raisi himself, in which case he'll be a weak supreme leader, where the real power will go to IRGC and the clerical establishment, which might clash over it. Or it might mean that he is not a contender, but someone else who we do not know yet will become the supreme leader. But the basic story here is one of consolidation of a regime power in the hands of a very small group of the clerical establishment and their militia friends in the IRGC who hold all the power in Iran.
So that's a good segue into your book, The Shadow Commander, which is about Soleimani, who was assassinated just a year or so ago. For people that are unfamiliar, because we always say the term IRGC when discussing Iran and U.S.-Iran relations, what is the IRGC, though, and maybe get into its history for my listeners?
The IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, is a militia that was founded after the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Now, what happened after the revolution is that, of course, an Islamic Republic was set up, and a decision was made by the proponents of the revolution under the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini, the first supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, that the institutions, the state institutions in Iran of the monarchical era, which had been in there for many years, could not really all serve the revolution. Of course, many of them carried over, including the military. But there was an idea that if we want to achieve the goals of the revolution, we need to create new revolutionary bodies. The most important of these bodies ended up becoming the IRGC, a militia that was sort of haphazardly put together in 1979-1980 out of different sort of guerrilla groups, Islamist guerrilla groups that had operated before, out of different groups who, you know, the Iranian revolution had become victorious by attacks on the military barracks, right? So there were arms in society, and, you know, everyone sort of had a gun under the bed, and these were being organized. So they were all put together under Khomeini's leadership. I explained in the book some of the process of how it came together, and that became the IRGC. That's the origin story of this militia. Now, a couple of important things about this militia. Number one, it's called Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. Notice something missing there, the name Iran. This is a conscious decision. They believe that this is not just limited to Iran, that it has to serve the goals of the global revolution of Islam. It has to export the revolution. That has always been one of its foundational beliefs. The other thing that's important is that the IRGC leaders have repeatedly said that they see themselves above the law, above the Iranian constitution, and they see themselves as a revolutionary institution that has to serve the goals of the cause of the revolution, even if that means breaking the Iranian law. So they act as, during, for example, the years when Iran had a reformist president, Mohammad Khatami, from 1997 to 2005, this reformist president was backed by millions of people. There was a mass movement. IRGC effectively worked as a opposition party, which, you know, organized thugs that would attack, you know, the youth movement and the women's movement and all that. So it has, you know, and it has, so it, one of the roles that it plays is sort of thuggery in society in support of their revolutionary cause, but the cause of the regime and Ayatollah Khamenei, that is. So this militia also has become an economic powerhouse. Of course, it controls something like half of the Iranian economy today, maybe a little less, maybe a little more, but its presence is everywhere. I've done, you know, multiple reports about, you name it, about its role in the Iranian startup sector, for example. I'm in Tbilisi, Georgia now, and I, you know, found out of many IRGC investment here. And they exist in Canada. They're everywhere. So it's an economic powerhouse, it's a military powerhouse. And of course, more relevant to the topic of my book, it is the force that carries Iranian foreign policy in the region. It is the one who appoints who gets to be Iranian ambassador into Iraq, to Syria, to Lebanon, to other places. These are not picked by the Iranian foreign ministry. They're picked by the IRGC, who also leads Iran's robust military interventions in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Yemen, and in Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So it is a mammoth of a militia that is stronger than perhaps all other Iranian state or non-state institutions combined.
So what would you say the main goals of the IRGC are in terms of foreign policy? What does the IRGC want?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The IRGC, its foreign policy is the IRGC wants to control power in Iran. And it does so by following a political program that seems to be aimed at cutting Iran's ties with the West, which, believe it or not, still are extensive in economic ties and sort of general direction, scientific ties. He wants this to be under control or decrease because they seem to empower IRGC's rivals in Iranian power structures. And it wants Iran to become a country closer to China and Russia in many ways. And it wants to also lead in what you can call an empire of destabilization. It wants Iran to continue what it's doing in different Arab countries by destabilizing them and by fighting some sort of a long, irregular war, if you will, against them, with the ultimate goal of confronting Israel, which is at the center of what it does. And of course, it has had an important role in arming both Hezbollah, the militia in Lebanon, which is fighting Israel from its northern borders, and Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which do so from Gaza in Israel's southern borders. Now, that's sort of what IRGC has been doing. But what we have to remember also is that it's a militia and a massive military organization. It's super corrupt and it has its own logic. These goals might change, by time, and especially as it becomes more powerful in Iran. And that, while for many people, as I said, these goals are important and they follow them, they certainly was, it was the case for Soleimani and others who very loyally serve Khamenei and believe in the ideological goals. So, they need to be taken seriously as much as the ideologies of the ruling communist parties in the former communist world or in China or Cuba need to be taken seriously. It is also a den of corruption. A lot of people are in it for the money. And, a lot of people are sort of primarily military people who are there and they're following sort of the political lead of the leadership, but might have different ideas for themselves. So that's what it generally does. But it's also important not to simplify such a massive organization and remember that it's not always united.
I want to discuss Soleimani a bit more, but before we do that, I think something that is always difficult for at least a portion of the American public to grasp is the sectarian issues. When we talk about the Middle East, Sunni, Shia, how does different sects of Islam play into politics and Iranian life?
So somehow similar to how Christianity is generally divided to a few sects, Protestants, Orthodox, and the Catholics, Islam is generally divided to two grand sects. You can say about 85% of Muslims are Sunnis, 15 to 20% are Shias, who also come in sort of different forms, different sort of heterodox traditions. So that's the general image. Now, what we've seen in the last 20 years is sectarianization of the region's politics. What does this mean? What do we mean by sectarianization? It means that a lot of political forces are using sectarian identities as their primary identity. And that basically they say, we are defending the Shia against the Sunni, or we are defending the Sunni against the Shia. Now, these include radical terrorist organizations. And sectarianism is, of course, the center of what you can call Salafi jihadism, as the scholars like Shiraz Maher and other sort of have called. This is basically a form of Islamism best represented in a group like ISIS, represented in milder forms in groups called like Al-Qaeda and other sort of Islamist groups. which, you know, it's anti-Shia. In many ways, it doesn't recognize Shias as, you know, as true Muslims. Now, it can go to, it has different sort of degrees. It can go to length of massacring the Shia, or it can just sort of tolerate them and exclude them. So that's on the other side. And of course, Iran, as being their only five countries in the world in which the Shia are in majority, and it's only one country in which, you know, Shia is sort of the official sect of country in the constitution, and sort of you know, the power is clearly organized around the Shia clerical class, and that's Iran. So Iran has emerged as the backer of the Shia around the region. Now, I think the important point here to remember is that Iran's sectarianism is actually very opportunistic, i.e. the men in power in Iran are not necessarily actually big Shia sectarians. Their Islamist ideologies, frankly, has bigger ambitions than just defending the Shia, which, as I said, are 20% of Muslims. That's why they speak of Shia-Sunni unity, because they believe all Muslims, and in fact, perhaps, you know, all the what they call oppressed of the world should be united to fight for these causes of their Islamic revolution. But effectively, they found out that while this stale old anti-Zionism and sort of all the slogans about Muslims of the world, oppressed of the world, are not very effective, unfortunately, sectarianism is much more effective, especially when, as I said, the other side also has been practicing different anti-Shia campaigns in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, but most importantly, in Iraq and Syria, and especially Iraq, since the 2003 war, where sort of the Iraqi society collapsed. Iraq is about 60% Shia, and a lot of these groups started killing Shia, attacking Shia shrines. So Iran has been practicing what this we can call opportunistic sectarianism. It knows, Qasem Soleimani knew, you know, it's much harder to get people to believe in the ideals of revolution and politics than to say, hey, you're Shia, you can join us and go fight for your fellow Shia. Unfortunately, this appeal to basic sort of sectarian identities can be a great military recruiter. And Soleimani made sure he did that. His armies that were fighting his wars in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, consisted largely of Shia youth from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, and from Iraq and Syria, and of course from Lebanon, where Iran's creation, Hezbollah, is the first and most successful creation of the Islamic Republic, really as a proxy or ally or whatever you want to call it in Lebanon. Soleimani would use this to have a united transnational Shia army that could fight its wars in the region. And also same in Yemen, where he defended a Shia local tribal movement called the Houthis, who had sort of a very general revolutionary Islamism of Soleimani, and the IRGC helped make their sort of generic Shia tribal identity into a anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic sort of revolutionary identity that would make them allies of Iran.
So I just want to stick on that for a second, because I guess the question I've always had is, especially after the war on terror, why wouldn't we end up having more of a working relationship with Iran if the enemy is sort of seen as Wahhabi Salafist? And it seems like that would be a shared enemy for a Shia country and the U.S. But you're saying a lot of this may have to do with sort of an opportunistic sectarianism, and maybe it's more complicated than simply trying to boil it down to
Sunni and Shia. Look, so the basic story is, again, I know this can be a little complex for listeners, but the basic story is sectarianism exists, but these political forces use it for their opportunistic reasons, right? It's the same thing as, you know, you can imagine in the United States, as many of these politicians appealing to like Christian or family values and saying all these things are not, you know, necessarily big family people themselves. They just know that appealing to these things will help them politically. So imagine that on a grand scale of trying to organize audiences and militias in the region, people have come to use this Shia identity, and then it founds its logic of its own. Same on the Sunni side, of course. They try to use Sunni grievances for political purposes. And I recommend Kim Qatas's excellent book, The Black Wave, about how the rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia has shaped, much of the history of the Middle East in the last 40 years. So that's what I would say. Now, back to your point about Iran and U.S. possibly collaborating in the war on terror. Well, as I explained in the book, And that actually is how things started. Right after 9/11, US did Iran a big favor by attacking Taliban, which was a force on its eastern border that was a Sunni Islamist force that was a threat to Iran in many ways, that killed Iranian diplomats in Mazar Sharif. Iran had actually at some point mobilized tens of thousands of its soldiers on its borders with Afghanistan, thinking that they might actually attack Taliban. They ultimately didn't sort of do this. But so US attack on Afghanistan was good news for Iran. And guess what? It because it was good news, it collaborated with Americans very closely. Qasem Soleimani's first interaction with the US, he was new in his job as the top of the Quds Force commander. This is the external operations wing of the IRGC. He was appointed to this job in 1998. A couple of years later, it's the US attack on Afghanistan. Qasem Soleimani collaborated with Americans. I detailed in the book some of the meetings. He had Ryan Crocker, an American diplomat, sort of was a leading of the American side. And Soleimani, while not always himself present, was, directing his people who in Geneva met with Americans. And, there's a stories of Iranians basically gave all the help they could to Americans in the fight against Taliban. They even gave them the maps and the positions and all of these things. But ultimately, of course, the Bush administration, whether we like it or not, decided that no, Iran was going to be part of the axis of evil. A term that he coined, David Frum coined, and was part of Bush's first State of Union speech in January of 2002. So you notice the timeline here, around a few months after the attack on Afghanistan. And this, of course, became a defining program of Bush's sort of policy that Iraq was gone and Iran was going to be the next in many ways. It was part of the axis of evil. So there was actually not only an opportunity, but actually happening Iranian-American collaboration against Taliban and against sort of what you can call Sunni radicalism, Salafi jihadism, whatever you want to call it, in the early years of the war on terror. But it was the Americans who ended it. Now, this is a version of history that I say in my book, and many others have also said. Of course, you can't do counterfactual things in history. The anti-Americanism of the Iranian regime was not going to just disappear because they were working with Americans on this. Who knows what would have been the sort of next step? What would have happened had Bush not done what he did? But in Iranian-American relations, the reason that it makes them to some sort of interesting soap opera is that there are always actions and reactions on both sides that you would think, oh, what if, right? What if this thing had happened? What if that thing had happened? But the fact of the matter is, during that early few years, 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 5 is when Ahmadinejad was elected and we had a change in policy, Iran really did try to work with Americans in many ways, but the Bush administration was not interested.
So, in regards to General Soleimani assassinated on January 3rd, 2020, after a drone strike launched by the United States, who was this man? What are the really important points that we need to get when talking about this figure and why his assassination still matters? I'm particularly interested in talking a little bit, at least, about his sort of younger days growing up. He wasn't necessarily from a really urban background, but he eventually moves to the city.
Yeah, so Qasem Soleimani came from a tribal background in the southern province of Kerman. It's also where my mom is from, so I have a sort of lot of links to this region. The basic story is Soleimani, like most Iranian people, had little to do with politics really before the revolution. Of course, Iranian Revolution 1979 is one of the ones with the most sort of popular participation in history of humanity. But still, that's a relatively small part of society. I.e., Soleimani might have gone to a couple of the speeches, but he was no political activist. He went to the gym. He was a Chad, as one of my sort of podcast hosts once simplified it as. This is the kind of figure that he was. But like many, and this is an interesting story of revolutions, that they're made by relatively few, but then they make the lives of many more. All revolutions are usually like this. So Soleimani was many who saw in the revolution and his institutions and his big plans. And of course, the first big plan was to defend Iran against the attack by Saddam Hussein's Iraq in September of 1980, shortly after the revolution, Soleimani saw an opportunity for a bigger life, for bigger horizons, to come out of his sort of provincial boredom. And he joined, like tens of thousands of Iranians, he joined the war effort, the 8 years long war of Iran and Iraq from 1980 to 1988. He joined them. He was mobilized in the war. He fought in the war. He mobilized many of his fellow Iranians from the province of Kerman and other southern provinces. And he, to the end of his life, basically, he joined the RGC in 1980 in his early 20s, and he never took off the khakis. He was a soldier of the IRGC to the very last day that he died in a U.S. strike, as you said, in January 2020. What was his life achievement, if you will? He was that from 1998 to the last day of his life, he was the head of the external wing operations of the IRGC. And what had been previously a haphazard series of tries by Iran to foment disturbances here and there and help its allies here and there, chiefly Lebanon's Hezbollah, which, as I said, was the most successful creation, Soleimani turned his state of affairs to a organized, disciplined, military, impressive, and sophisticated united army that was able to fight wars in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, and simultaneously, right? And help. If today Hamas is able to confront Israel in this military impressive way, is largely thanks to Soleimani, actually, who was, and the RGC, of course, as a whole, but Soleimani person, who tried to really upgrade the military capabilities of Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Hezbollah, and others. So this is really the story of his life, that he was able to build one of the most successful, we can say, transnational military operations in modern history, which is why he became a celebrity, not just in Iran, but around the world. You know, he was on the cover of Newsweek. He had his own sort of profile in New Yorker, he really emerged as this international military figure. That's the story of his life.
I remember when the assassination happened, I think you referenced this at the beginning of the book, actually. You know, you could find hashtags saying, you know, hashtag World War III. There's been a lot of concern over the years about war with Iran, about the relationships between the U.S. and Iran. What do you make of the U.S.-Iran relations as an issue, and why should Americans be concerned about it?
Well, we should be concerned about it because the worries that were around. Look, we should be concerned about it because the United States is obviously a military superpower in the region that Iran is, i.e. Persian Gulf. Americans have a very extensive military presence. For example, there is a Gulf Cooperation Council, which it includes six Arab countries by the side of the Persian Gulf that are traditionally go from rival to antagonistic to Iran. I mean, with the exception of Oman, which is sort of more friendly to Iran. But, United States has military presence in every single one of these countries. There's military bases in them. It has a very extensive presence in the Persian Gulf and the southern waters of Iran. And of course, in Iran, you have an official anti-American policy. You have every year a Death to America rally where people come and shout Death to America. It's part of the official ideology of the regime, anti-Americanism. It's what it tries to mobilize people, usually unsuccessfully too, because most Iranians, are certainly not anti-American. If anything, they're usually admiring of America much more than of their own leaders or of their Chinese or Russian allies, frankly. But the reality is, this is a war waiting to happen in many ways because now America under Biden has a different sort of policy. But the reality is so much extensive American military presence and added to Iran's anti-Americanism and IRGC's anti-Americanism provide a lot of opportunities for possible clashes. And of course, America has also imposed very heavy sanctions on Iranian society that went to historic height during Donald Trump. Again, in the I'm a historian. I don't usually say in the history of first time in the history of humanity just for the hell of it. This is truly the sanctions the United States has imposed on Iran are the heaviest in the history of humanity. I don't think we've had this anywhere. And you know, they have destroyed the Iranian economy and really have had an adverse effect. They've been a stupid policy, if I may speak frankly, because they have actually, you know, what happens when ordinary Iranians can't trade, right? They can't go to universities, they can't trade. Well, you strengthen the hardliners, those who are able to use those black market channels, those who are able to use illicit channels. So it has strengthened them. So long story short, you should be concerned because this is a very dangerous confrontation between two countries where it can actually lead to a lot of, there's a lot of opportunities in different points of the Middle East that could, you know, clash into a war and become something much bigger. And because America's punitive sort of sanctions on Iran have really weakened the Iranian society, the Iranian people, and strengthened, and the hardliners in Iran have been no friends of democratization in Iran. Now, what should U.S. policy on Iran be is a complicated topic. I recommend a beautiful article by my friend Karim Sajjadpour. I think it's called How to Win the Cold War on Iran in the Atlantic Monthly, where it's all the more fascinating because, of course, it's not sort of an extreme one or the other. Karim shows, gets over these simplified cliche debates about, you know, moderates and hardliners and this and that, and shows how U.S. needs a smart set of toolboxes to deal with, with the regime in Iran. Of course, I speak as Karim is really speaking there as sort of advising on American policy. I speak more as a sort of Iranian progressive who also does believe in Iranian-American friendship and, of course, in democratization of Iran. But I think the policies that he suggests are actually also best for democratization of Iran and for Iranian progressives.
I just had a few more things I wanted to touch on very briefly. The first being, and I realize that, you know, you're more of a historian, so maybe this is more of an opinion question. How would you assess Biden and U.S. foreign policy towards Iran under Biden so far?
Well, as you know, it hasn't been that long. It's about 6 months. I think that we've seen some welcome changes. The fact that they've tried to get U.S. back to the JCPOA, and which is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, basically a nuclear deal between Iran and the six other powerful countries, which Trump left in 2018, known as the Iran deal. Biden has been negotiating with Iran, trying to get back to it. I think that's a welcome change. I think diplomatic negotiations are good news, basically, of trying to, you know, lessen the tensions and go toward lifting the sanctions on Iran, which are ultimately bad news for Iranian hardliners and for the, you know, sort of Ayatollah Khamenei's loyalists, and are better news for Iranian society. But it's a tough question. And, it's only been 6 months. It's also linked to other issues. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict that's been top news in the last month. And of course, Biden has had a bit of a different position on it. But I should take this opportunity to say, of course, you know, everyone wants to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and it's not so easy. But that would be a very important step. Just imagine if the Palestinian problem is not there anymore, the Palestinian independent sovereign Palestinian state is formed, and other grievances of Palestinians are taken care of, the Iran's anti-Zionism and its sort of playing up with the Palestinian cause will have much less of an effect, and Hamas would not be such a close ally of Iran anymore. And I should also say, in relation to Iraq, you know, strengthening the Iraqi government of Mustafa Qasemi, and having it stand up to Iranian influence and letting it be a sovereign Iraqi government that has good relations with Iran, but also with all the Arab countries, with Saudi Arabia, with Egypt, Jordan, would be important. Now, what's the critique of Biden administration? Well, like Obama, actually, and in a way like Trump, they all pledged that they basically want to get the hell out of the Middle East, right? They want to pivot to somewhere else. You know, it's Asia-Pacific. Trump spoke about ending the forever wars and all that. But in reality, Middle East keeps distracting. Now, because of all the events happening in the Middle East, I would say that an effective Iran policy would need serious American attention on a number of fronts, including, strengthening the Iraqi government. As I said, finding a negotiated end to the Syrian civil war, trying to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or restrain Israel a bit more, frankly, which is the only way we could actually get towards solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is by restraining Israel's sort of unilateral moves, the building of settlements and everything else that has made the two-state solution become almost impossible. So basically Iran policy can't be analyzed in isolation from all these others. And the critique you can make of Biden administration is that it's just not that interested. And it's also, as I said, been only 6 months in, and this is a government that for very good reasons is going to be domestically focused in many ways. Of course, America has, after all, just gone through the COVID crisis. It just went through the Black Lives Matter movement. There are many important issues inside America, which is ever more polarized, that deserve attention. And no one can blame President Biden for wanting to focus on those. But the problems of the Middle East have American complicity in them. They won't change unless enough attention is given to them. And we haven't really seen that yet on every case. And as for the policy of Iran, as I said, 6 months is a short time. You can only try to assess the policy in a longer term, especially because Iran, as we discussed earlier in this interview, is going through a very different phase in its life.
I just wanted to add to that. I think the key point there is, I think the Biden administration, generally speaking, has sort of said that it wants to focus more on domestic policy in the U.S. Rather than, looking at all these foreign policy issues, which, as you pointed out, it's sort of understandable, but it could cause issues in other ways.
That's right. Yes. The problem of wanting to pivot away from the Middle East, it's like you can't put all your, you can't put so much money and treasure and problems and then say, well, we need to pack up and leave. Even if you do want that, even if you want to do a long-term strategic reconsideration, you still need to, you need to sort of solve some of the problems when you're in. I mean, this is a complicated topic, of course. On the left, the call basically has long been for, and I'm on the left, as you can guess, the call has long been for basically anti-interventionism, right? Less U.S. everywhere better. I mean, I don't think that works, because what does it really mean to have less U.S.? I mean, I think, of course, America's predominant power around the world is unhealthy. It's bad for the international system. And, it has led to American imperialism, frankly. To just basically withdraw also is not really an answer, because the United States does have this predominant power. And it is also buttresses much of the international community. Now, the liberals, like Obama, like Biden, like Secretary Blinken, have long spoken of their belief in multilateralism, of international society, of the United Nations and all that. Well, a robust defense of them and of these principles and of these institutions means that they gotta intervene very particularly in this. Now, by intervene, I don't always mean military intervene. I almost never mean military intervene. But they must pay attention to these issues, especially when the American forces are there, right? You can't, just pulling them out won't always help. Now, in Afghanistan, they did that. I'm not an Afghanistan expert, so I won't discuss that. But in Syria, I would definitely be against withdrawing American forces, which are supporting the Syrian Democratic Forces now, which control a big part of Syria and are, frankly, easily the most progressive force in the Syrian civil war. So it's anti-interventionism, of the way that is dominant on the left, is not very principled and doesn't always lead to results that progressives advocate for everything.
In closing, when it comes to your book, The Shadow Commander, and of course, this is a book about Soleimani, but I think it's much more than just a book about Soleimani. I think there's a deeper history that we can see through looking at the life and times of Soleimani and his assassination. Could you comment on that?
I mean, I, you know, my assumption when I write a book like this, this is my first book, but, you know, my, I hope to write many more books. My first assumption is that the reader is very curious and interested and, you know, fairly educated, but doesn't necessarily know a lot about the Middle Eastern history. So, you know, it's no fun if you write the book assuming that everyone knows everything already and you're making a minute sort of intervention somewhere. So, yes, I have tried for this book to be a history of the Middle East of the last 40 years. Now, you know, there are different ways to write a big sort of history. One is that sort of you say all events, but the one that I'm very interested in, I think this is what a lot of novels or movies are like. You know, you take one actor and you follow it. And through that, you tell the history of a region, of a process, even of the broader sort of world, right? So that actor, I love biographies. I love nothing like biographies for precisely this reason. So, because through the story of one man or woman, you can really learn much about, you know, much about time. Now, maybe you read a biography of Beethoven and you learn not only about a great musician or a genius musician, but you learn about Napoleonic Wars and Napoleonic Europe and the growth of ideas and all that. Now, I've written a biography of a soldier. I'm not a military historian, so I haven't really written a military history. In fact, that's why it's not a straight up biography. That really should be written by a military historian. It would probably be a few times as long and rely on many sort of more varied sources, including many military sources. I mean, I've used quite a few myself, but, you know, it would be different. So what I've tried to do is through the story of a young boy who was looking for greater horizon in the world and thus became a military soldier, a legionnaire, as you would say in the Roman Empire. Through that, I've tried to say the story of how is it that these Islamic Republic that came out of the revolution in 1979 directs so much of its resources around the world, and how is it able to run so many military interventions in the Arab world, and how has it changed the politics in the Middle East? So in short, yes, it's a story of the last 40 years in the Middle East, of last 40 years in Iran, of the last 40 years of Iran's interventions, Iran's internationalism, if you will, Islamist internationalism, set through the story of the one man who had the most effect in running this story in the last 40 years.
I also, just because, you know, I thought I should mention it here at the end or get your thoughts on it. Since you mentioned the left and anti-interventionism, you know, I do think about things like, you know, blowback to foreign policy decisions the U.S. has made in the past and the problems that has caused. And, you know, it does sort of lend credence at times to this sort of anti-interventionist viewpoint. How would you respond to people who take that viewpoint or think things like, you know, oh, what if this policy causes blowback down the line?
Look, the United States is a superpower with massive economic and military power around the world. The blowback theory, you know, is perhaps correct in many instances. I have no doubt about it. But the United States is already involved in much of the world. As I said, I do believe America's predominant power and the way it overpowers international institutions is unhealthy and it needs to change. But, you know, the trick about changing things is that you can't just change. You know, if you want to get, you need to think about what are the consequences of your actions, right? As I said, withdrawing American support for the SDF in Syria, for example, won't lead into a more peaceful world with any definition. In fact, it will probably lead to the growth of forces that will be very detrimental to Americans, whether it's the Assad regime and the Iranian regime, or in fact, the terrorist forces that the SDF has been fighting, like ISIS, right? So, you know, we should definitely critique American interventionism from the Vietnam War to these days, the American excesses of power, the foolish, futile war in Iraq that, I say futile, but it was also, of course, criminal. It killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. It destroyed a society. It was against international law. It's absolutely horrible. But there is no doubt about that. But the fact of the matter is the United States, you know, doesn't have the same sort of, you know, we can't just sing from the same tune book. We criticize the American policy in Iraq because of this, but some people say the same thing about Syria, even America is not actually that involved in Syria. Now, I'm not saying you should have been military involved, but I'm saying progressives need to have a vision of the world a need to have a vision for American foreign and military policy. That is a vision for a superpower that it is. It should definitely, you know, new institutions like Queen's Institute that are calling for restraining and sort of running these sort of articles, they're a welcome part of the debate. It's definitely good to push back against interventionism, but it needs to lead into a coherent foreign policy, frankly, which we on the left, frankly, don't have. You know, we don't really have a coherent foreign policy for America. A list of wishes that don't make a coherent foreign policy, whether in the Middle East or everywhere else. And unfortunately, a good policy doesn't always make good campaign slogans, right? Because, you know, people in universities, they like to shout US out of this, US out of that, this, you know, it's kind of very catchy slogans, but they don't always make to good, wise, you know, foreign policy that is in accordance with the values of the progress. It's just like when we advocate for healthcare and you know, for domestic needs against police brutality, we do so based on some values. We should do the same international affairs, and they're not so simple, right? If you look at leftist organizations like Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, of which I'm a member, there are many different takes on what the US foreign policy should be. And that's fine. We can have different debates about it, but we shouldn't have so much of an orthodoxy, and we should, anti-interventionism, strict anti-interventionism, US forces out of everywhere is neither a policy nor a, really effective in any way. We should have a more worked out based on the region, based starting from the reality, starting from the world as it exists, you know, rise of China, presence of Russia, the Iranian regime, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as it exists. You have to have a policy and as it exists in relation to the actual existing problems of the world, not just, not just saying a wish list of things that apply to, apply to any situation regardless of the world as it is.
Well, Arash, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. If there's anything else you'd like to add or let my listeners know how they can get a copy of the book, The Shadow Commander, please just give that a plug and anything else you want to say in closing.
Thank you so much. I just, thank you for interviewing me. Thank you for listeners. Please support my book by buying it in any way that you can. It's available on Kindle. Perhaps that's the easiest. You can get a paper copy if you're in the United States. Your independent bookstore, wherever you are, has it. It's also on Amazon and all Barnes and Nobles and all the websites. But going to an independent bookstore is always the best. And supporting first-time authors by buying their books so that they're taken more seriously and can write more books, and supporting books about history and Middle East, which are not always, on the top of the book charts is great. So please do that. And I would also say that, I'd put a plug perhaps for New Lines, a great new website about Middle East writing. I've written a piece there myself. I'm hoping to write another piece soon about Iran and Raisi and sort of the future of Iran under the likely new president Raisi. So I would say that if you want good, informed, educated takes on the Middle East, you could hardly do better than New Lines. Also, Iran Wire is great as a source of, those who are more into Iran and want day-to-day analysis of Iran. I recommend this website.
Well, I want to thank you again, Arash Azizi, for coming on Parallax Views, and I hope everyone checks out your book, The Shadow Commander.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Arash Azizi, author of the book The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter @ViewsParallax or by email @ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Rats, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.